Hello, everybody. Welcome to a French Village podcast. We're talking about episodes 11 and 12 today. I am here with my brilliant friend, Ben Wittes, who I can't see for the first time because we're recording on a different platform. And so it's so weird not to see your face, Ben, but I know that you're here.
But it is great to hear your voice, Sarah. And I have a special message for JVL, who I noticed in the other day announced that the secret podcast Monday show was going to be suspended until the end of a French Village podcast. And I just want to, express condolences to JVL, who has been concerned, as listeners know, for some time that Sarah's engagement with this project would cause him to be replaced. And now he has been replaced. So I just want to say,
I'm glad we're doing this maturely. That is not why I can't look, whatever. I'm not going to get into my schedule.
I know it's not fair, Sarah. I just, you know, JVL makes it so easy to tease him about this that I just can't resist the opportunity.
Well, speaking of jealousies, a lot of relationship drama in the penultimate and season finale of season two of French Village. And, despite the there's obviously the cliffhanger on the show, but I think the big cliffhanger is really whether or not we're going to be renewed for season three.
It's true, because this is the last episode of season two. And
that's right.
The big question of will the Bulwark keep producing this show? I mean, are the numbers we're putting up adequate to justify a season three of the French Village podcast? I think, folks, if you want this show to come back next season, and by next season, I mean next week, you better tweet at the Bulwark, French Village season three, free season three is going to be the hashtag. So, let's hear it, people.
Yeah. And go, if you get a chance, go rate us on Apple, iTunes and all that stuff. A lot of people have been doing it and I love reading them. All right, Ben, let's jump into these episodes. So we enter into episode 11, and like a lot of shows, this is one of those where the penultimate, or not a lot of shows, but I feel like this show may actually have been ahead of its time in doing this, where the penultimate episode is actually kind of richer than the finale. The finale tends to be a little more, it does some cliffhangers at the end, but there's a lot of loose ends being tied up, whereas the penultimate episode is extremely rich in dynamics and drama. And so we start episode 11 with Larcher in jail because he did that thing that you thought was very stupid, where he put on Marcel's sort of hat and coat and went out and is captured so his brother can get away. And Hortense comes to see him and he is not happy to see her at all.
Yeah. I mean, he apparently has a line that she has now crossed and it was not, having an affair with Marchetti, the police officer, and it was not having an affair with Müller, the SD officer. You'd think that might have pushed him over the line, sleeping with the Nazi who's, killing people in your town. But no, his line is only when she manipulates his nephew, Gustav, into revealing that his father, which is to say Larcher's brother, is going to be at the house and then reports that to her lover, the Nazi, and thus gets them, almost gets her his brother arrested and gets himself beaten up quite badly and arrested. That's his line. So we know, I mean, again, we could make analogies to certain Republican politicians for whom the line keeps moving. But I think in this case, it's a little bit more personal than that. It's not a political line. There is a huge amount he can tolerate from Hortense, but her manipulating his nephew to endanger her brother to keep her lover in town is a bridge too far. And so he is now announces wants nothing more to do with her, and he wants a divorce.
Yeah, I mean, just to be clear, Gustav is her nephew too. Hortense is the worst. It's nice to hear that Daniel wants to divorce her. But then, of course, it kicks up this dynamic, which to me is an inexplicable from a storytelling standpoint, which is that Hortense seems to entirely almost not change her personality, but she becomes all of her motivations now stem from wanting Daniel to be okay. Right. So she's white hatting a little bit, and she's running around to Marchetti and to Mueller and basically saying the same thing to both of them. I'll do anything, which, of course, Marchetti takes gross and full advantage of. But she's now decided. I mean, after doing the most, I guess you could say. I guess it's possible that after somebody really kind of hits rock bottom morally, and uses a child to try to save her lover, her German lover, from being sent to Minsk, she gets religion and says, "Oh, yeah, that was really bad," and now she's all on a tear to save Daniel, despite him wanting to divorce her. Do you buy this kind of personality shift here?
I actually don't think it's a personality shift. I buy it completely. And I think but it's not a personality shift. At all stages of the show, up into her apparent death at the end of this season, which we'll get to in a moment, she is the one infinitely selfish character and wants to have it all. She wants to be a mother to Tikiero, the baby. She wants to be a respectable wife and have a respectable home from Danielle. She wants to have whatever lover she is focused on that day. She wants to pay no price for it. And so she seizes things and people and doesn't want to give them up. And so, you know, this is also why I think she is, in the previous few episodes, flitting in and out of the house, staying in a hotel with Mueller, but perfectly content to show up and expect Danielle to treat her like his wife when she chooses to show up at home. And so, you know, she does not want Danielle to get hurt. She wants Marcel, his brother, to get arrested so that her lover doesn't get sent to Minsk. And when that backfires and it causes problems for her husband, she actually wants to protect her husband because she likes her life in which she has the husband at home and the baby at home and the lover or the choice of lovers. This is a very congenial life for her, and she tries to hang on to it. And she tries to hang on to it both from Mueller and from Marchetti, both of whom she tries to get to intervene. And then she tries to hang on to it from Danielle, who she keeps negotiating with to stay in the house. So I think her behavior is actually quite consistent and quite comprehensible.
Okay. I mean, actually, that was a good explanation. I will say I found it weird, you know, the previous episode, or at least in the previous two, she's sort of tearfully lamenting. She's deeply in love with Mueller and can't believe he's going to be sent away. And it's so sad. And now she's just sort of like, I can't believe you arrested Daniel. We're done. It just seemed a little, I don't know. It seemed sort of abrupt to me.
I guess I would have thought that, you know, she's one of these characters who doesn't know or care anything about the geopolitical world in which she's operating. And she's distinct in that from Marie, who has a instinctive understanding of it, from Sarah, who, you know, actually speaks from jail to Danielle, gives him the kind of moral lesson of the two episodes, and from, you know, some of the more, as well as from some of the more worldly characters, she lives in this very small world in which there are goods and there are men and there are women to assert rank over, and she's not unlike Janine in that respect. And I think she doesn't start with the principle, this guy is a Nazi. That's, you know, don't even look at him. She starts with the principle, oh, this is attractive, I can get this guy. And I think she's a very simple, a very simple kind of selfish evil.
Mm-hmm. Okay. Yeah, I guess I could see that. Hortense isn't the only person who visits Danielle in jail. Sarah also comes to see him. And as you note, this episode is kind of buttressed by Sarah visiting Danielle in jail and then later Danielle having to visit Sarah in jail. When Sarah is there, she's just kind of giving him a quick update on the kids. But Mueller walks in, and him being the intelligence officer he is, immediately picks up that Sarah is important to Daniel. You know, grossly, like, puts his hand on her and then, you know, tells her he solved that paperwork problem for her. You know, talks about her ingratitude to him. To Daniel. But Daniel is, so now he's talking to Mueller in jail, and it basically is, give up your brother or I'm going to torture you. And Daniel won't give up his brother. So it sort of sets up the most intense scene. I don't know if it's of the season, but it's, Mueller then, you know, he takes Daniel to his office, puts him in the pretty chair, the chair that I think is too nice for torturing. And then he brings Hortense in. First he brings Hortense into his room the way that he normally does. And he kind of sniffs her, you know, like says his own goodbye to her before, shutting himself down completely on her and bringing her in as bait to get Daniel to talk.
Yeah, so there is a, we've had indications before that Mueller is a genuine psychotic, or not psychotic, but a sadist.
Yeah.
So those sort of come to fruition here, and they're actually presaged in that, in a scene in the jail where he tells Danielle proudly that he, in Poland, loved a woman and yet had her decapitated, and says it as a matter of, you know, there is nothing I won't do to get the information that I need. And I loved this Polish woman very much. And yet I tortured her and had her head cut off. And so it's a little bit presaged by that. We know that, I mean, leave aside whether he's capable of anything we would actually call love. He is certainly has some kind of feelings for Hortense, including possession and possessiveness and whatnot. And yet he is, I think, positively eager to torture her by way of torturing her husband and getting him to talk. And of course, this is one of the more effective forms of information gouging, is not actually inflicting pain on the subject, but threatening to inflict pain on subjects that they care about. This actually, you know, the Nazis did a lot of this for those who, a lot of people gave a lot of things up to protect people they cared about. And you can understand why. And Danielle, though he has just told her he wants nothing more to do with her and wants to divorce her, actually cannot stand to watch her, you know, cut up by this Nazi chieftain. And so he is prepared to give up at that point, but in a turn that only a script writer could love, the German commander Krollwitz, who is in the tradition that the show is exploiting a bit, and has some elements of truth. Of course, the Wehrmacht the Prussian officer corps were the least Nazified of the armed German forces. And so this guy is, you know, doing his duty as a soldier, of course, which may include some horrible things, but isn't a crazed sadist. And he is, you know, appalled at what's happening and orders Danielle freed, because he is, you know, the mayor, of course, and orders Müller immediately to report to be transferred to Minsk. And so the torture never quite happens, but for a small injury on Hortense's arm. And of course, but Müller gets his parting shot, which is on the way out the door. He removes the protection for Sarah, thus setting up her later travails and arrests, because Sarah is, of course, in addition to Danielle's, I would say, sort of budding paramour, Jewish.
Yeah, I just want to go back to Hortense and Müller for a second. They really deserve each other. The scene where he is saying to her, "This is about my career," I have to do this and find the, because this is about, but you know, my career, and you know, you should give up everything. Like, the both of them are so deeply selfish and self-centered that you sort of feel like they really could have a future, almost sociopath to sociopath.
So they are highly sociopathic. She is not a sadist. She doesn't seem to enjoy other people's pain. She just doesn't seem to care or notice it very much. He is an active sadist. There's no question that the SS attracted people like that. There were a lot of people in the SS and the SD who enjoyed their work, you know, and a bunch of them after the war went to Argentina and, you know, and Paraguay and became torturers for you know, other regimes. I mean, there was this group of people that, you know, got off on it. And I think there was a, you know, Mueller is not based on any particular character as best as I can tell, but that quality of, it's become a bit of an archetype. Of course, made famous in the movie Marathon Man by the portrayal of a Joseph Mengele type character by Laurence Olivier. But the idea of this sort of highly refined, very fastidious SS officer who is, you know, beneath the surface veneer of gentility, a crazed sadist, has become a bit of an archetype in movies and stuff, but it's got a germ of real truth to it. I mean, you know, there were a bunch of these people all over Europe, and, you know, I'm not sure any organization ever collected them quite the way the SS did.
Yeah, you've got to be a particular type of person to feel like you're just like cool to put cigarettes out on people's skin. And even with – it's funny. I had remembered this scene because it's – you don't know how it's going to turn out. So you're – when I watched it the first time, this idea of him torturing Hortense was like – just really shocking. And I, in my head, in retrospect, I thought it was like they pulled out fingernails, because that in my head is like a very terrible form of torture that I causes me to feel bad in my stomach. But it looks like he was more like a pincher type thing. And he you know, just got her in the arm. But like, I don't know what that kind of thing where like the person that you've been having an intimate and emotional relationship with, he was just, you know, tearfully sharing records with her, to then be like, and now I'm going to torture you, is a takes a special kind. And I would also like to say, just as a junior sociopath, Marchetti gets Marchetti should get a nod here for, you know, the way he forces Hortense to pay for his favor,
which is to say, let's be frank, demands oral sex in the police office.
Yeah, and it's gross. And he's got that with the thing about Marchetti. I quite like this actor. Because he does this like world weary thing. You know, he's kind of putting his hands over his face, like, ugh, Hortense, and you're sort of like with him because you're like, yes, she is insufferable. And then of course he never gets obviously to the level of bad that Mueller is, but he's pretty terrible.
Agreed, but I do want to draw a distinction between the two.
Yeah, we had to do this last week too, because I keep going in this direction.
Marchetti is a very garden variety, corrupt, abusive official. Every society produces Marchettis. You go to a big city police department in the United States, there will be somebody who, you know, has abused sex workers for sex, or, you know, or has beaten people, right? Marchetti is a... And the, you know, the thing about Vichy is that it elevates some of those people because it's a deeply corrupt society and government. But I think Marchetti is not a special kind of evil. He's a very ordinary kind of evil. Mueller, the kind of person who is essentially a professional torturer, who, you know, I think is a different breed. And I think the fact that Marchetti learns from Mueller, but not the other way around. Mueller has nothing to learn from Marchetti. Is a is emblematic of that.
You know, it's a good point, but I do think that part of the reason I always have such a reaction to Marchetti is exactly why you say I feel like you could I could encounter a Marchetti in a way that I feel like it would be very hard for me to encounter a Mueller.
Well, and the show makes that very vivid, right? Mueller is foreign. He is imported. He is in this fancy office with a picture of Hitler.
With eyes of the bluest steel.
Yes. He's a little bit exoticized in a way that I think is reasonable, because there was something exotically bizarre and evil about these people. But Marchetti is literally begins the show living in your house. He is
right.
Literally part of your community. He is, you know, and I think it's much more the different, like he's much more the Derek Chauvin kind of figure, right? He's somebody who's in your community, who's very recognizably part of your world, and who's capable in a routine arrest situation of putting his knee on somebody's throat and killing him. And that feels much more intimate and much more immediate, because you can imagine that it's your house, not Daniel Larcher's house, and you put this person up and he, you know, first he's sleeping with your wife or your husband or whoever, or you're, you know, first taking advantage of you, right? And then coercing sex from that person. And then, you know, oh, he learned that you can put out cigarettes on people's arms, and he's kind of attracted to trying that. You know, he feels much, much closer to you.
Yes. So I want to talk about the conversation you alluded to between Daniel and Sarah when he goes to see her in jail at the end of the episode. So like you said, the parting shot from Mueller is to rescind the paperwork. So, you know, very polite soldier, French sort of soldiers come to the door and say that they need Sarah Meyer to come with them. And Daniel goes to see her in jail and basically says, like, you're going to a concentration camp. But at the time, the camps didn't have, you know, there was just this idea of you were kind of went with your own people and were held somewhere. It didn't have – no one sort of had this sense of what goes on yet, I think, in concentration camps. And she says to him in a way that I'd forgotten – but in no uncertain terms, with the kind of moral clarity, you're part of this. You help make this happen. And he is genuinely shocked to hear her say this. And she says, I'm fond of you, but you are, this is the collaboration. What did you think about that conversation?
Okay, so I want to get to that, but I want to back up and note a couple historical points about this, because I think they're really important. And they relate to stuff we've talked about with respect to past episodes. So the first is that the concentration camps that she is being sent to are French camps. And it was one of the creatures of Vichy that they did the roundups for the Nazis. And these camps actually predated the German invasion. We had talked a little bit, remember, earlier about Takiero's father and getting sent to these camps. These camps were French camps that were used for basically detentions of, you know, foreigners and increasingly of what they called foreign Jews. Now, Sarah's status here is finally cleared up. We finally have a clear explanation of who she is in relation to Vichy law. She is originally from Czechoslovakia. She comes to France and is naturalized as a French citizen. She comes to France presumably as a child, is naturalized as a French citizen. Then, if people will recall, we talked earlier about the October 1940 Vichy edicts that caused Madame, sorry, I've lost her name, the school teacher.
Morhange,
to lose her job. So one of those edicts related to Jews in the civil service, but another of them denaturalized a whole bunch of recently naturalized Jews. So there is a reference in a discussion with the deputy prefect to her status under the October 1940 edict. And so Sarah is one of these people who thinks she's a French citizen, but then Vichy comes in and they basically say all those people who became French citizens recently, particularly Eastern European Jews, you ain't really French citizens. And these people were the people who were most likely to be killed in the Holocaust in France, because they were, in fact, rounded up mostly by Vichy itself, put in these concentration camps, French-run concentration camps, and then they were super convenient to just put on a rail line to Auschwitz. And that's actually what happened to, you know, it's basically 30% of the French Jewish population over the course of these 4 years. And so the most vulnerable of this group of people are the people like Sarah, who are Czech or Russian or Polish in origin, some Yugoslav, but mostly those three countries. And they come in to France in the years before the war. They get naturalized, and then Vichy denaturalizes them. And this is why she is subject to arrest and detention. Again, the show is precisely legally accurate as to her status and like what happened to people like that. So she is not arrested for a protracted period of time because the Nazi chieftain in the region, as a favor to the mayor and Hortense, basically waves his hand and says, leave this one alone. The moment he is pissed off at them and is sent to Minsk, that protection is waived. And then, of course, the French, as we talked about last time, the French authorities, because they are so keen to preserve their own sovereignty, do the arrest themselves, mm-hmm. right? Because they don't, if Germans start arresting people on the street, that looks bad for them. So they end up being, and they, you know, they were like quite anti-Semitic themselves. So they're actually content to do a lot of this stuff themselves, hence the degree of complicity that a lot of French officials had in the implementation of the Holocaust in France. So all of this is embedded in the story of and there are these little allusions that you can pick up, and that's the actual history behind the arrest of Sarah Meyer. And then, you know, she is portrayed in earlier episodes as very bright and very capable intellectually. She does the kind of forensic accounting. It's not clear how old she is, but she's very, very smart. It is not clear from the earlier episodes that she is very wise. She does some stupid things, like go on that date with the guy in the movie theater. But here she is sort of channeling the filmmaker's wisdom, right? And she is actually, this is as close as there is to a lecture from one of the characters about the moral truth behind this thing, which is you can't get in bed with these people at all, or you become an instrument of them. And that is her message to Danielle. You've always been very good to me, but don't kid yourself. You're part of the fucking problem. And that's, of course, the way the audience experiences Danielle. Like, you like him at some very basic level. He's a good and decent person. and he is unambiguously part of the problem. And you can't dine with Müller. You just can't do it.
Yeah.
And she's the one who looks him in the eye and tells him that.
And reminds him that she bears the cost. That he gets to, you know, Daniel is trying to do the right thing and trying to do it for other people. And he clearly has a very humanistic commitment to others. But it is just like Lucienne and Mrs. Morhange, there is a constant, they're not the ones who have to pay the price. It's these other people who do. And so it's hard for them to wrap their heads around that culpability. But if you're Sarah, you look at it a totally different way than if you're Daniel. And I will just – the other thing that the show – one of the things the show does, I think, as we get into these later episodes and things start to move and potentially we start to lose people. Not saying that Sarah's lost. I'm just, that she's going to be sent to a concentration camp. It is sort of gutting. Like you start to realize like they've made you care about a whole bunch of people. And as we move on, we know not everybody's going to make it. And I feel listening to Sarah, I feel the loss of her already.
So I don't know, as somebody who has literally never watched an episode of the show beyond the week that we've recorded, I don't know what happens to Sarah Meyer. In reality, the Sarah Meyers of the world were killed at a rate of something like 90%.
Right.
And, right. They did actually better in France than they did in other parts of Europe. But they did not, this is not a population. The population of Czech Jews in France in 1941 is not a population that lived past 1945,
yeah,
as a general matter. And so whatever happens to Sarah Meyers in particular, understand that, in fact, this is a group of people that survived the war at a rate that should continue to embarrass and humiliate French respectable people like Danielle Larcher.
Mm-hmm. Okay, so we have to move to, we gotta start moving here. The one other big sort of thing that happens in episode 11 that we need to talk about, is that Marcel has, he's living in the woods. The communists, his buddy Paul, who is the worst, except for all the other people who are the worst, but Paul's not great. And they show up and tell him, I mean, there's a bunch of other stuff, but the gist of it is they show up with Suzanne and then tell Marcel, hey, she's the one who dined you out. She's the one who dined out Yvonne, and you got to go walk her into the woods, tire her out, dig a hole and kill her. And they're quite explicit about how she has to be killed with the two bullets, and they give him a gun. And then Marcel and Suzanne traipse off into the woods. They're really taking us on an emotional roller coaster. I forgot how harrowing this episode 11 is. But what did you make of the scene where Marcel and Suzanne, he has to sort of confront her and decide what to do?
Okay, so I actually did not love this scene. I thought that it never occurred to me that he might actually do it, which made the drama of the scene work not so well.
Yeah.
I knew immediately that he did not have it in him to kill Suzanne. So I actually think the scene didn't entirely work. The portrayal of Paul, who is from the beginning of his entrance into the show, represents mindless Stalinism.
Yep.
Is is consistent and maddening in its consistency. It may be a little bit overdone. I mean, he never deviates at all. but that said, you know, Marcel is a hardcore communist with a bit of a rebellious streak that both causes his communism and makes him a kind of less than perfect party member. And let's face it, Suzanne is one of the most engaging and attractive characters in the entire show. And you are in Marcel's place here in that the party, you know more than he does, of course, because you know how Yvonne was actually captured. Right. But she is more persuasive than the party, and he is not so doctrinaire that he can't see that. He's also very fond of her, and, you know, they have a little thing going. So he backs out and lets her escape. And then, of course, Paul wants her wedding ring, so he has to go back and say, "Hey, I took your shoes and didn't kill you. Can I have your wedding ring now?" And so it's they're all, I guess I would say, you know, the Communist Party was like the third worst organization in France during this period, the third, fourth worst major organization. But because it was actively fighting the Nazis, at least in this period, we have to romanticize it a little bit. And I think one of the interesting things about the show is that it kind of resists that. And it, you know, it shows them as, in this case, a corrupt organization that is willing to kill an innocent woman to cover up their own incompetence, and that they don't really care if she actually gave them up. It's just she's the one that it's convenient to pin this on. And I think that's probably pretty accurate, that, you know, this was an organization that we only remember with anything like fondness because the partisans were fighting the Nazis. But at the end of the day, they were Stalinists.
Yeah, they're terrible. I just can't stand Paul from start to finish. So let's finish up Marcel and Suzanne. So yes, he has to go see her again to get her ring to prove she's dead to Paul and the other guys before they're going to help him escape. He ends up spending the night, and then you're right about that scene not particularly working. But one of the scenes that I like quite a bit is one of the things about Suzanne, and this is sort of central to why people don't trust her, is because she's got this relationship with Lariat, who is one of the cops who works with Marchetti, and he really likes her, and she's using that to her advantage. She's supposedly an informant for him, but it seems like mostly he just likes her. But he shows up, Marcel ends up, spending the night, and Lariat shows up when he's not supposed to, too early the next day. Marcel's still there. And there's this scene of them kind of circling each other because they're looking for Marcel. And Lariat kind of pulls out a cigarette, lights it, hands one to Marcel. And it becomes clear that this is not the territory, that they're like out of bounds right now. They're like the game of cops and communists that they're playing, where he has to go catch Marcel, is like in a timeout in this in Suzanne's apartment for whatever reason. And they have this sort of great exchange where Lariat says, you know, anyway, we'll get you in the end. And Marcel says, probably, but we'll get you in the end too, which ends up being true, broadly speaking. So I liked that scene. And then this is the thing about, you know, episode 11 is very tense. Episode 12, we lose everybody. You know, like at the end of episode 11, we lose Sarah to the concentration camp. We in episode 12 lose Suzanne to Switzerland, where she's got to go and pretend to be dead in order to protect Marcel. Marcel is on his way to is it to Paris to go hide out because he's wanted for this for the shooting, which he's been on the run from now for a couple episodes. And then, of course, there's some big losses toward the end of the episode as well. So
before
episode,
you go there, just a thought about this scene, which I also loved. You know, there's the immediate text of the scene is that they're out of bounds and not in the game because they both care more about Suzanne than they do about their politics, right? And so Marcel has betrayed the party to protect her, faked her death. And Loriot is protecting her and betraying the national police by way of, you know, he's willing to not arrest Marcel in order to make sure he gets her to Switzerland. But I think there's another there's a subtext to this text, which is that Loriot is basically saying, hey, in public, I have to arrest you and kill you. But, you know, we love the same woman. And by the way, I kind of dig killing German officers.
Mm-hmm.
Right? There's a little bit more political. You're a commie and I'm a nationalist, but we're both French and the fucking Krauts have invaded our country is the subtext of this, right?
Yeah.
And so, yeah, in my public capacity, I've got to chase you and you've got to try to kill me and I'll do my job in public. But when we can join forces over a woman and share a cigarette, I don't have a problem with what you did.
Yep. Yeah, there's a lot in that part where you're sort of unsure where it's going and he hands Marcel the cigarette. It's a good scene. It's a loaded scene. I think you're spot on. Maybe even more than you know a little bit with your read on that. Okay, speaking of politics that are bubbling to the surface, Kremieux, the Jewish businessman who works with Schwartz, shows up at the school. His daughter, is a student at the school, and he asks to see Barry out in his office, and basically makes it clear that they have some friends in common, that he knows that Barrio is somebody who is open to being a little political, and he's trying to get his hands on the school's printing press. And in the conversation that they have, you can tell Barrio is interested a little bit, but when he talks to Lucienne about it later, she says, you know, don't get involved. And she says something like, I think this is the part where she says it, where if I was a Jew, I would want to be invisible, you know, right now. And there's this way that Barrio looks at her where you can tell he like flinches almost, that this is how she would think about the situation. Because she's sort of saying that she would be surprised that Kremieux would be resistance, like he would be part of the resistance. And Barrio's kind of like, well, why wouldn't he be? Like, makes sense that Jews would be part of the resistance. But you can see him becoming more aware of just how sort of her damaging a political positioning, and also how much he is wanting to lean into his politics.
Yeah, it's a very interesting relationship because it's the first time you detect disappointment on Berlioz's part with Lucienne, other than in her rejection of him. You know, he puts her, as a general matter, he puts her on a crazy pedestal, and, you know, she's this very ordinary, kind of uninteresting person whom he idolizes. But here, like, the ordinariness and the inability to see, to even imagine around corners why somebody like Cremieux might be interested in getting hold of a printing press, sort of bothers him a little bit. And and it's, again, it's very subtly played. You know, one of the neat things about Lucienne as a character is that she vacillates between, there are aspects of her that are very appealing and aspects of her that are kind of maddening. And this is, you know, she has allied herself matrimonially with Berlioz for reasons of protection and for reasons of safety. And you see in this scene that she is actually incapable of understanding why anyone would choose to do anything else. And he, who offered her that deal, is actually capable of political courage. In these little ways, right? Like singing a Republican song at an event, or being a little bit forward leaning about encouraging people to dance, right? But these are small acts of resistance, and they're actually showing them as a little bit of a wedge between the two of them. And then, of course, he goes with Cremieux to see the printing press, and, you know, quite despite himself, ends up kind of wrapped up in Cremieux's nascent project of printing pamphlets.
Yeah, he's sort of like, but what would your pamphlets say? And it's interesting, actually, because he immediately says, well, you wouldn't endorse the attack. You know, you would only condemn the shooting, which is a moral position I very much understand. But Cremieux kind of says, nope, both. You know, we're the attack. And it's interesting where he makes the most affirmative case you've heard for what the communists are doing. He says maybe they're premature. You know, maybe it was too much too early, but they're right. They're showing the way, and we're not going to shy away from it. And Berlioz goes from sort of being against that position to trying to find a way to kind of write the pamphlet. And he's riffing extemporaneously. Well, I could say this. And Cremieux realizes quite quickly that Berlioz has a real knack for propaganda. And it's not propaganda, but whatever this would be called.
Yeah. So, but I think this is the other sort of scene where there's a kind of moral voice of the show, right? Where Cremieux, like, as when Sarah looks at, and of course these are about brothers, as Sarah looks at Daniel Larcher and says, you're a good man, but you've really got your head up your ass about this and you're enabling the Nazis. This is Cremieux saying to a Republican moderate like Berlioz, hey, you know, Marcel Larcher, he doesn't know he's talking about Marcel Larcher, but the other Larcher, who's an unpleasant individual, by the way, who's not nice, and who just, you know, shot somebody in cold blood or was part of an operation to shoot somebody in cold blood, that this is actually what resistance looks like. And, you know, that's I think that pairs with Sarah's like there's no, Sarah says there's no way to dine with them and not be a villain. And Cremieux says the other side of that coin, which is once you accept that, you got to start shooting them. Now, there may be an argument that that's not right, but and that that's a complicated conversation. But I think that's the those are the two moral moments of the show where, you know, they're both Jewish, but they're from wildly different castes, right? Cremieux is a big industrialist and Sarah is literally a domestic servant. They're both saying there's just no there's no compromise to make here. There's, mm-hmm. you know, there's either you are dining with them and you are part of the problem and getting people like me killed, or you're taking whatever opportunities you can to shoot them.
Yeah, and not to I guess the one of the contrasts I would draw to contemporary politics is it's sort of the difference between the people who went into the Trump administration and said, well, I'm going to limit the damage, right? I'm going to make it so whatever happens is
the
less
Daniel
bad.
Daniel Larches.
That's right. Versus the people who said, you cannot – like, and even I – like, so I could understand that position, especially early on. And yet there was a lot of people, the ones that I fell in with, who said – no, there is no you, this. Anything you do to help them, you know, legitimizes what is a totally unacceptable enterprise. I mean, it's not quite corollary, but I do see some of that in it.
The corollaries are never precise because the Trumpists are not Nazis,
right?
Despite the rhetoric of the other of. A lot of their critics, but I do think there's a look. There's a important other element of the parallel you've just drawn, which is at some point, if you're Cremieux, you have to say, if the world is between the Nazis and the communists, I'm with the communists. And that's this, you know, this is a French industrialist banker businessman whose side project is an optics factory, right? Like that's his passion in life is the lens factory, right? This is a capitalist. And he says, if you really as a society put me in the position where the only people who are shooting the Nazi invaders are communists, then count me with the communists. And that's exactly, in a smaller microcosmic scale, the debate between the Never Trumpers and the, you know, it's not the moral stakes are not the same. We're not talking about Sarah sending Sarah Myers to concentration camps. But the people like you said, if you force me to choose between Trumpism and Democrats, I'll take the Democrats, including the knowing that their coalition includes AOC and Ilhan Omar. I won't endorse that. I won't, you know, but I will ultimately ally myself with that coalition rather than accept this. And I don't think it's a terror, like, you know, I don't believe in Nazi comparisons. It's not a terrible metaphor for this.
Yeah, and I'll just, you know, I completely agree that they're not even precise, they're not even analogous. But I will say that there are things like child separation, you know, where it became an official policy and there were people inside who were, you know, trying to keep it from becoming a policy, but who ultimately were unsuccessful and then found themselves in the place of implementing that policy. And I've never understood how people didn't just quit en masse during parts of this. And so there are things like that where people were trying to do the right thing, but ultimately became complicit. And I think that
And the Sarah Myers scene is that scene, right? Where she looks him in the eye and says, if you're still the mayor of Villeneuve at this point, you're part of the problem. And I love you, and you've been very good to me, and I'm kind of in love with you, and I know you're kind of in love with me, and I'm like, and I really hate your wife because she's really awful, and you know all the things that I know, but I just got to look you in the eye and tell you, you know, you're part of the problem. And Danielle takes that from her in a way that would not take that from others. And he then, in a subsequent scene, is much more forthcoming with Gustave about condemning what is happening. And that is a direct outgrowth of that conversation. And similarly, Cremieux, who is the other sort of this other dialogue, is the other sort of moral voice of the show here, is saying, you know, at some point, to translate it into modern terms, if the occupying force, if in a two-party system, one party is altogether evil, you have to be on the other party's side.
Imperfect though it may be.
Murderous though it may be. These are the same guy, like, you know, these guys are not the, you know, Joe Biden. They're Stalinists. You know? They are the second worst people of the century.
All right. We've got to dispatch with a couple other things. Danielle, after all this, he's taken the hard line on Hortense, wants her out, tells her that she's really trying to stay. He says, no dice, you're gone. We haven't even talked about Schwartz, who buys Maria Farm, which is, I guess, the equivalent of a sugar daddy pad. But he after spending the night there with Marie and hanging out with her kids, decides he's going to go and tell Janine that he is leaving for good. One of the things we neglected to mention at the end of the episode 11 is that you do see Dick Verne taking the money from Caberny's lover and clearly giving up Schwartz. At the end of the episode, we see that Cavern is taking Mrs. Moorhenge for her operation, and they're going to spend 10 days in a hotel in Paris to recover, and she looks happy as a clam. Schwartz goes to tell Janine that he's leaving. And I will tell you, as bad as this character is, sometimes I like the actress who's playing her. She is doing this character real justice. Because I really thought she was fantastic in the scene where he says he's leaving and she first says, you will not get to see your son. I'm going to withhold your child from you. And then she kind of just immediately goes into a bargaining mode. Like, first she threatens, then she bargains. She loves him. If he wants to go somewhere else for a while, that's fine. She can take it. He says, no, he's out of there. And then she really starts to threaten. She's going to tell the cops about him, take away the factory, everything. And he bails. He has that dead look in his eyes of, I'm done with this. And he walks out, only to be scooped up by do you know this guy's name?
I don't remember his name.
Boyfriend.
He's the deputy prefect's nephew.
Nephew, right.
And I just think of him as nephew. But he does have a name. I just don't remember what it is. They scoop him up and take him to the river. And there's a confrontation. And he ends up shot. Which is, you think he's stared the guy down, actually. But then he gets shot in the back, which he does not seem all that upset about. He seems to kind of welcome it. It's not clear whether he's alive as the show ends, as the season ends. He fidgets a little bit. That could be, dying spasms, or it could be that he was, it's just a flesh wound. It's not really clear what his status is. He seems like too major a character to be killed this early, but okay. We kind of don't know what the deal with him is, right?
That's right. And he's not the only one. So this is like this episode, they like you kind of are like tying up
kind of a massacre.
Yeah. And then all of a sudden, Danielle comes home and sees Gustav, and he says, Aunt won't leave. She's upstairs sleeping. And he goes up and looks like she's committed suicide and taken a vial of poison or something. And so at the end of episode 12, Suzanne is out. Marcel is out. Sarah is out. Schwartz is out. And Hortense is out.
And Marcel is, being whisked away.
Yeah. Didn't I say him? I said him.
Oh, did you? Sorry.
Yeah. But it's okay. It's a lot of people, a lot of our characters. So I remember watching this, the first time and being like, oh my God, what are we going to do?
Yeah. Gonna have to airlift some new characters into Villeneuve.
That's right. We will have to wait to see if we get renewed, for season three to find out what happens. But until then, thank you, Ben, for all your thoughts.
Thank you, Sarah. Notice that I used the Sarah, not Sarah, because, in honor of Sarah Myers.
I appreciate you've named yourself Hortense on the Squadcast.
Yeah, on here. The Squadcast thing. I try to give myself one of the characters' names every time. We will be back next week. And until then, Edith, take us home.
Nous nous aimions bien tendrement, comme s'aiment tous les amants. Et puis un jour, tu m'as quitté, depuis je suis...